This week, a bigot and full-blown conspiracy theorist named Marjorie Taylor Greene won the Republican congressional nomination for a U.S. House seat in Georgia. Greene has a long, ugly trail of videos and social media posts that indicate total detachment from facts and truth and basic notions of decency. She has railed against Muslim Americans winning congressional seats, calling it a Muslim invasion. She's falsely accused a prominent Jewish American of having once been a Nazi. She's questioned whether horrific acts of mass shooting in the United States were faked to bring about gun control. She believes, frankly, so many crazy theories, we don't have time to go through them all.
That was CNN's Jake Tapper describing Marjorie Taylor Greene, a QAnon curious candidate who recently won a Republican primary for a House seat in Georgia and is now likely to advance to a seat in Congress. Happy Monday and welcome to the Reason Editors Roundtable. I am Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who is currently enjoying the sunshine on the best coast. With me today to talk about QAnon, the Democratic National Convention, and more are Catherine Mengu Ward, Nick Gillespie, and special guest, Jesse Walker. Everybody say hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hi, Peter.
So before we get to discussing the true meaning of Q, let's start with another bastion of total detachment from facts and decency, presidential politics. Last week was, in many ways, the pregame event for the final stage of the 2020 presidential race. Joe Biden finally announced his choice of running mate, and it turned out to be the person that most of us suspected and worried it would be all along, California Senator Kamala Harris. The presidential race starts in earnest this week with the Democratic National Convention. As you may have noticed, it is being held in the middle of a pandemic. Originally scheduled for Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in the middle of July, this year's DNC is instead being held in August, and it will be held nowhere at all. It's going to be entirely virtual, with none of the major players in the host city. Like so much of our lives, the DNC has been turned into a glorified Zoom chat. So for 2 hours, each night, Monday through Thursday this week, Americans will have the opportunity to watch Democrats tout their presidential ticket via selfie cam. The speeches are going to be a lot shorter, just a minute or two in many cases, instead of the usual 10 or 15. And while there will be some stagecraft, many of the speakers will be appearing from their own homes, talking to the nation live from their living rooms. The whole thing is going to be much more like an evening spent through flipping through TikTok or Instagram Live, much more than a traditional crowded political event. It's the Democratic Party on endless scroll. So I want to start by going around the group and asking how you feel about all of this. This is going to be a really, really weird convention, guys. So what are you all expecting from this week's festivities? What are you looking forward to or not looking forward to, as the case may be? Nick, let's start with you.
I'm actually excited to see how both the Democrats and the Republicans hold a virtual convention, having gone to the 2016 versions, which were already weird, particularly the Republican one, because no Republicans wanted to show up for Donald Trump, high-level people and whatnot. Scott Baio was basically the top-line entertainer there. So, you know, this is at least the second in a series of weird offbeat conventions. I'm actually looking for, in both of these cases, because there's basically going to be about 2 hours of live streaming, from what I understand, each night at the Democratic convention. That is prime time. I want to see how they deal with their overall pitch to vote for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. They are exceptionally unattractive candidates, I think, and their program is generally unpopular, which is just massive expanded government in every possible way. But they have the real benefit of running against Donald Trump. I just saw polls saying that the single biggest reason that people who are say they're going to vote for Biden are voting for him, 56% said that he is not Donald Trump. Seeing how that plays out over multiple days.
That seems like messaging. A big advantage that he has over Trump that Trump is going to have a hard time countering.
Yeah, it's almost a lock solid argument. So I'm interested to see how they go with that, and also then how much they alienate people in the middle. You know, we have because people talk mostly about Trump, less attention has been given to how far left or, you know, that's not even the right word, but how big government style Joe Biden has been, how, you know, Kamala Harris, who I wrote last week and was scorned for this by libertarians. I think she is the most libertarian senator on pot legalization, which I would stand by. On everything else, she is a total shit show. So I'm going to see. I'm interested to see how they lay that out and what people think.
Jesse, what are you looking forward to with these conventions, or not looking forward to?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the first big glitch, because I'm sure the first Zoom convention will screw up terribly in at least one way. And basically, it is entirely meta for me to watch this. I want to know what a Zoom convention looks like. I want to know if it will be more boring or less boring than the usual sort of convention. I don't think it's going to make a whole... Oh, and I'm also curious what the ratings will be. This is the sort of thing I am least interested in usually with conventions, but I really want to know if this is going to have a train wreck quality that keeps people watching, or if viewers will just tune out even more frequently than usual. I don't think it's going to have a big impact on the election. I've certainly seen conventions have impact on the election. I still vividly remember 1988, the first election I voted in, where the Republican convention really turned things around and shifted all the momentum, or did, you know, from Dukakis to Bush. But at this point, I remember in 2016, the Republican convention was so low rent. So many people didn't want to go. They had like a multi-level marketer speaking. It didn't matter. They still won. And I think that at this point, both parties are going to be so low rent that unless there is a major gaffe, I can't imagine there being a big difference. But the fact is, Trump and Biden are the two most gaffe-proof politicians in history. The two people where it's completely baked in that you expect them to say goofy nonsense, and it's not going to change what you think of them because everyone's used to having Biden and Trump around. So
they're like the Mr. Burns disease thing, where like he had every single disease, and therefore all the diseases blocked all the other ones, and he was totally
exactly.
Fine.
Yeah, they canceled each other out. So I guess I'll just sort of be watching out of the corner of my eye and doing whatever editing of recent posts I'm supposed to be doing during it. But I don't expect there to be any kind of big impact, either politics-wise or policy-wise.
Catherine, you're super excited about the convention, right?
Always am, for sure. Now, I actually, I am typically super excited about the debates, because those are the opportunity to hear politicians pretend that they care about policy, or sometimes to have politicians who actually care about policy talk about it. And I think the format for the conventions, which is the sound bites only format, obviously is going to discourage any kind of policy discussion. Like, I just don't see how, when you're given a minute, you're going to use any of that for anything other than a list of buzz phrases, Medicare for all and climate justice and the end.
Think we're going to get some coordinated like dance memes? I mean, if they're going to do this actual TikTok style.
Please, God, let there be dancing. Honestly, like, I can only hope. But I do think, you know, the one person whose long speech I am going to regret not having, assuming he doesn't get one, is Bernie Sanders. I think letting Bernie Sanders speak at length at a Democratic convention would have almost 100% odds that it would have produced interesting results. I don't know, helpful, unhelpful, but it would have been something. And I'm guessing that they will be taking the opportunity of this format to restrict the time that he is given. If they don't, great. I'd love to hear from him. But that, you know, that to me is going to be a loss. In many, you know, long, long ago in the before times, when I went to a couple of conventions, I always loved covering the daytime speakers, because they have this big convention hall. And so they might as well put people on the stage all day and give the delegates who don't have friends something to do. But it's, you know, that was always just such a rich vein for me, especially as a junior reporter, because people do say wacky stuff and they do kind of show their hands in ways in the kind of JV hour that the more polished evening convention speakers typically don't. I have very fond memories of Zell Miller, if y'all remember Zell Miller.
Oh, yeah.
Just letting loose. So I'm sad that that's going to be eliminated. I am torn about, like, I appreciate politicians not getting to just go on and do their stump speeches, having to come up with new material, which I think almost all of them will for this, is often like reinvigorating and refreshing. But I would have liked a long-winded Bernie stem winder, and I'm sorry, we're not going to get that.
So apparently Bernie Sanders pre-recorded a backup version of his speech. I don't know how long it is.
Oh, so it's like the national anthem at the Super Bowl.
But is he going to lip sync
like it? Houston.
I think we can. Yeah. I think we can like combine your hope for a long Bernie Sanders speech with Jesse's hope for technical glitches and like a full minute of Bernie Sanders trying to figure out how to get himself off of mute before. Oh, they
should
end
we take
up...
bets? We should take bets about which who is the first person to have to be told. You got to unmute your microphone.
I think there's a good chance that we'll have Bernie Sanders giving a speech while his backup accidentally plays in the background, and he'll do the sort of double track duet with himself, which would be fun. Can I take
it's going to be like the Zoom echo, right? Yeah, so I'll tell you what I'm looking forward to, and it's Billie Eilish's performance on Wednesday,
yes.
Which
oh
is the same night that Kamala Harris is speaking. And the teaser image that got passed around, I think all of you saw this in our Slack, the teaser image of Billie Eilish is just amazing. She's just got her like eyes rolled back, like comically impossibly far into her head, this sort of like perfect teenage sneer about she's like it's like I hate everything, I'm bored with life, mom and dad made me clean my room, now I'm gonna go start an anarchist commune or at least like write a sad song. And that's exactly how I feel about the Democratic National Convention and watching it this week. So let's actually talk about the other big star on Wednesday night, who is Kamala Harris. Nick, I want to start with you here. There has been actually a lot of discussion that you brought up a little bit of this already about whether Harris is a moderate, about whether she represents a middle of the road safe pick, or whether she's actually a super left radical who is going to control the Biden campaign and is actually like the puppet master behind all of this and is going to end up running the country from the vice presidential office. So first of all, do you think that it matters at all whether or not we characterize her as a moderate? And how would you characterize her policy and governing record? What does it say to you about how she'll campaign and how she would be in the White House or close to it?
I think that her record, and I looked at the stuff that she was saying when she was running for president, and when all of those racist, sexist, xenophobic Democratic primary voters kicked her out as fast as possible. I mean, it's kind of stunning. I was thinking about this the other day where people were saying, oh, you know, the Republican response to her is hostile, blah, blah, blah. It was like, you know, it was Democratic primary voters who were like, get the fuck out of here, including Black voters who supported Joe Biden vastly more than Kamala Harris, et cetera. She, as I said, she has done a turnaround on criminal justice reform, on immigration for the most part, and she's really turned away from being a drug warrior to being, you know, an open advocate for legalization in a way that Joe Biden is not, and only Donald Trump of the four, you know, presidential and vice presidential candidates, only Donald Trump approaches her, and he's not as outspoken on the issue. On everything else, she is truly awful, and she... It's hard to say, you know, are you to the left of Joe Biden or not? Because he, you know, he's like the Simpsons. You know, he presents a Simpsons problem where, you know, comedy writers will say every plot, every joke has been made on the 30 plus years of the Simpsons. Joe Biden has supported every political position of the past 50 years in American politics at some point. So, you know, he contains multitudes. But she is awful. She wants to increase spending massively. She backtracked away from a dumb kind of ignorant exclamation that she wanted Medicare for all to something not Medicare for all, but certainly disastrous. She's terrible on tech regulation. And she spearheaded, you know, and pushed a back page prosecution. She's interested in talking, you know, she wants a $15 minimum wage. She wants to study reparation. She's in favor of paid leave. She's anti-college students taking on debt. She wants campaign finance limits. She's a nightmare from a libertarian perspective, with the exception of immigration, criminal justice reform, weed, and abortion. And, you know, it might be worth saying that that's actually not bad. That kind of she's in a lot of ways, she's the antithesis of Mike Pence, who is bad on a lot of issues. But she's also super anti-trade. She's anti-NAFTA. She's anti-USMCA. She was against the TPP. I would love to be in a world where she is called out on this of exactly how do you separate from what Trump is really about in a lot of ways. I don't think we'll see that. And I apologize for going on a bit at length, but I had done so much research and she's just really, truly awful on a lot of things. But then the other question is, like, does it matter? And I don't think it does. Even with an ancient 78-year-old Joe Biden, who's last seen in a campaign video that he released driving around in an old Corvette talking about his dad as a good driver and how he literally can't get out of second gear in this video. It's just bizarre. But even with that, nobody really cares about the vice president. In very few instances, you know, Dan Quayle hurt George H.W. Bush a little bit, but it's, you know, this is almost negligible in terms of how this will impact the election, even with an ancient mummified candidate like Joe Biden at the top of the
table. So my question is, can Harris serve for Biden the way Biden served for Obama, which is to say, can she be, I mean, this is at least one theory of the Biden vice presidency, is that he was the floater of trial balloons, right? That, like, everybody knew that he just kind of ran off at the mouth sometimes. And so he's out here legalizing gay marriage and it's, you know, a big fucking deal and all this stuff. You know, I think Harris does have attributes that would position her to sort of do some of that for Biden. Biden is nice Uncle Joe. He's not Donald Trump. He wants to be as much of a cipher as possible. But Harris can say stuff and see what people think. And then when people flip out, you can say, oh, well, that wasn't the official position of the campaign or of the presidency.
In some ways, that's what she did on her during her primary run with Medicare for All, where she just said stuff. She was the first out the gate. And then it became clear that the stuff she was saying wasn't going to work. And she had to backtrack and flip flop and backtrack and come up with a new plan that was the same as the old plan, but not really.
Landed a bunch of attacks on Joe Biden.
Yes.
You know, I mean, she can be nasty, which is a traditional role of a vice president to really go after people. And what Catherine was talking, I think another function of Harris in this might be if she brings out the worst in Trump and Trump advocates and, spokespeople, that will serve a function. Because I think in a lot of ways you have nobody, you know, people don't like Donald Trump, terrible approval ratings. People are unenthusiastic, to say the least, about Joe Biden. But there's vast people in the middle. If they get a sense that the Republicans are, you know, kind of racist, kind of xenophobic, kind of sexist, kind of, I think, and Harris might conjure that because we've already seen some of that in people talking about whether or not she is, you know, under constitutional rules. Can she be the president, et cetera? Like that might be a meaningful function for her to play, to bring out the worst in kind of xenophobic, sexist, racist Republicans.
Jesse, Nick talked about, sort of raised the question of whether or not any of this matters, and he sort of argued that it kind of didn't. The vice presidency is just such a weird job. In theory, a vice president doesn't really have to do anything except sit around and be available if the president, for some reason, isn't. And in this case, polls show that voters are more worried that might actually happen. With Biden, he would be the oldest person to win the presidency if he won in November. He has not pledged to run for a second term. Do we need to pay more attention to Harris because of Biden's advanced age? Do we need to think of her as somehow or another more influential on this ticket than a vice president might traditionally be?
I don't think that within the context of this ticket, we need to pay extra attention to her. I do think, my big concern about Harris being picked is that means she's sort of being set up to be the 47th president. I mean, if Biden wins in November, which there's a very good chance will happen, then she is sort of the natural successor. And as someone who has seen her soften and turn around a bit on criminal justice reform, I don't trust that. I think her basic instincts are still prosecutorial. And I think she's not someone I enthusiastic about the idea of having her in the Oval Office. I want to also go back to one thing you said earlier, though, this notion of her being like the radical puppet master pulling Biden's strings that some people have been bringing up.
I mean, that's
on the
Trump
GOP
campaign's
side.
Line. That's not just some randos on the internet. That is the actual Trump campaign. The Republican National Committee is making that argument pretty explicitly.
But that was going to be, they were making that argument 2 months ago as a sort of a fill in the blank thing. In June, you had Lindsey Graham talking about how Joe Biden is a figurehead and the quote unquote radical mob is pulling the strings. So if there was any plausibility at all, and plausibility sort of defined loosely, the vice president, I mean, unless he picked, you know, Mike Pence as his running mate, this was going to be
that would have been weird.
That would have been weird.
That would be
the ultimate insurance Mike Pence, you know, and then he could go to Acapulco for a while. But I mean, the GOP strategy in general for the last couple months has been to keep pointing, you know, at the late night Portland riots and things like that, and present themselves as the only alternative. And the problem with this strategy politically is that most voters who are not already in the bag for Trump don't see Biden as a radical guy. They see him as the third alternative. And there's a lot of people who say, all right, well, you've got Trump on one side and you've got a riot on the other. And Joe Biden is the straight down the middle candidate. And I think that's one reason why that line of attack just hasn't worked for the Trump team. And so there's been every effort to sort of say, well, it's not Biden, that sort of grandfatherly guy who has been, you know, broadly popular for at least the last 10 years or so. It's the mayors. It's this governor who's doing a mask mandate. It's these people in the street. And now Harris is the one being slotted in that role. I don't think it's going to work for them just because it's, you know, people generally don't pay a ton of attention to the vice presidential candidate unless it's a sort of Dan Quayle style super gaffe prone person. But I'm not surprised to see that line of attack. And I think it really is just sort of fill in Kamala Harris's name where anyone else would already go into this attack ad.
Can I give you guys some good vice president facts real quick? Because was Wikipediaing the vice presidency this weekend.
Can't really say no.
You can't. You absolutely cannot. So suck it up. I just want you guys to know that there was no discussion at all of the vice presidency at any point in the Constitutional Convention until the very, very end, when a committee of 11 members, which was literally called the Leftover Business Committee, realized they needed to figure out the mechanism for what turned out to be the Electoral College, and that the decision to make the successor to the presidency, the vice president, the runner-up in the presidential race rather than the head of the Senate, was exclusively to resolve a voting strategy math problem for the way the Electoral College was constituted. So the vice presidency is just to basically prevent electors from using their second vote to show solidarity with their hometown candidates or other symbolic acts. And that's it. There's no vice president until somebody's like, oh, crud, the voting doesn't work. Okay, whatever. Let's just create this office. And it's like the last day. They're up against the deadline. It's like, fine. Now we have a vice president. And that matches with the history of the office thenceforth, I would say.
And then on the fourth election, they realized that they had not realized that if everybody voted for two candidates as a ticket, they would end up with a tie and a disaster.
Right.
And they had to completely scrap.
In fact, it did not work at all for the stated purpose. But that's where it came from.
Okay. The most important and least important office.
I do think that we would be a radically different country if Aaron Burr had rightly won election.
But he was the bad guy in that musical, Nick.
Speaking of Billie Eilish.
Yeah. And he, you know. By the way, Billie Eilish, I'm hoping against all, you know, reality that she will somehow sing a song that is fundamentally about homeschooling and school choice at the Democratic
Party
convention.
All her songs are fundamentally about that, Nick.
She's famously a homeschooler.
The subtext is always there.
And actually, she doesn't even go to the common room in the house most of the time in her song. She's just in her own room. But, you know, there's an irony here that should not go unnoticed that, you know, a product of homeschooling, and her whole family is very much into it. Her brother, who's also her collaborator and producer, talked a lot about it. He was in a movie that had something to do with homeschooling, in fact. You know, that she's now singing at a party that is, you know, really more than anybody else wants to turn schools even more into low, you know, minimum security prisons that are mandatory for K through 12 children. So, you know, maybe that will be the thing that we remember 1,000 years from.
We're all in a prison of our own making here, Nick, is what we're in. We're all
locked inside. Well, yeah, but this is the thing. K through 12 school is not, but that's the state doing it. Like, this is, it's a libertarian prison when you do it on your own. But when you
screw,
when you
imprison
your own mind.
But in the lockdown era, Nick, they're not in low security prisons. They all have ankle bracelets on at home. So
that's true. Yes, that's true.
All right. All right. Catherine, I am going to really decline to make a Billie Eilish joke or transition here. But just suffice to say, there's so many possibilities.
Missed opportunities. All of them.
So we have been over a bunch of the ways that libertarians are not fans of Kamala Harris for a variety of reasons related to her record as a prosecutor, attorney general, and senator. But for many voters and for many pundits, she's not just a policy track record. She is a woman of color on a major party ticket. And what's more, she's a woman of color on a major party ticket who was viewed as the safe, obvious, and smart choice for Joe Biden, pretty much definitionally an old white guy, right? Like, if you just say the words old white man, the image that pops up in your mind is Joe Biden. And she was viewed as not a risky move, not as a big, bold statement. And politics, you know, I sort of want to talk about that because politics is and always has been for many people about identity and representation as much as it is about policy choices and governance. How do you feel about the role that Harris is playing here? And how should libertarians who care to in a lot of ways about equality, about sort of equal opportunities to be vice president or president, how should libertarians feel about that approach to politics and the way that Harris and Biden are engaging in
it? Oh, sure, Peter. Ask the lady how she feels about the lady.
Yeah, I was
going
to say.
This is Matt Welchian levels of hosting.
At least don't sugarcoat
it. Matt Welch couldn't be here, but he did send me some questions that I should ask.
Yeah, Matt Welch is appearing with the Proud Boys and the Boogaloo Boys out on the West Coast. Is that right, Peter?
Right. So this is, I mean, I think this is a great example of politics as a lagging indicator, right? The rest of the country in many, many, many major industries, in many major institutions, has long since become not only reconciled to, but flat out positive about the idea of women and people of color in leadership roles. This is something that is old news everywhere except politics. And it is not surprising that it took politics, and I would say the Democratic Party is there, the Republican Party is still not there, a lagging indicator of the lagging indicator, but it is, you know, it's not surprising that they are sort of the last to the party. I will say I do not love that Joe Biden announced the category first and the person second. I think that sucks. I think that is the wrong way to do this thing. I think that it has always been true that there are highly capable women and highly capable people of color in every industry waiting, working, trying to get their way to the top. And that when they did emerge and do emerge, it's something to celebrate. And I also think that to say, I am choosing a woman, I am choosing a person of color, that's that. And then backfilling the individual is not the way that I think anything should function. I think the individual is the fundamental unit of society. It should be our fundamental unit of consideration. We should see people as individuals first and take other considerations second. So I wish Joe Biden had not announced the category and then the person, and instead had just chosen the person and let people draw their own conclusions about the categories that she belonged to. But yeah, it's totally a sign of progress. And as always, politics gets there last.
Let's talk a little bit about the way that Republicans have reacted to Harris. Nick, you brought this up earlier. They have raised concerns about whether she is legally qualified to be vice president. There are, apparent, as far as I can tell, no actual issues. She was born in California. She is a citizen. She absolutely qualifies. Yet President Trump, members of his campaign, have given voice to this theory, at least said, oh, sure, I've heard about it. You know, just raising questions, just talking about this, right? At which the New York Times, among other places, has called a racist conspiracy. Trump, meanwhile, has also called Harris, quote, extraordinarily nasty and so angry. Nick, what does this say about the Republican Party, about President Trump, but also about like the general tone and tenor of the race we are about to watch? What are we in for here?
By the way, what was great is that when Trump was concerned trolling about Kamala Harris's meanness, he said, you know, she was very mean. Literally, he said she was very mean to Sleepy Joe in the debates. So it's just,
like,
I mean, we're in a world
of more than two edges.
Regress.
Like, it's a triple edge.
It's an infinite regress. I mean, you know, we are so far through the looking glass on all of this stuff. And it's related to the Jake Tapper snippet at the beginning of the podcast. The Republican Party is under Donald Trump. It has really divorced itself from any kind of consistent or coherent politics. And that may, you know, it was enough to get a Trump White House in 2016. It may be enough to squeak out a victory in 2020. But in the long run, it's a bad thing because in a different way, the Democratic Party has also gone really dumb. And all they are talking about, for the most part, is getting bigger and bigger and becoming more the federal government should be more things to more people and involved in every aspect of lives that we can't even imagine yet. It's neither of these parties is very thoughtful. Neither of them has a real vision for the country. Trump actually did, arguably in 2016, he was running against an establishment. He was running against a bunch of played out institutions, concerns, temperaments, the roster of people who were in D.C., you know, draining the swamp. He didn't deliver on any of that. And he now is, you know, arguably incredibly incoherent, not just in kind of his nattering sometimes in his tweets, but in, you know, how he thinks about what should the world look like? What is America's
role? Do you think he has become less coherent, Nick?
Yeah, I do think so, actually. And his, you know, and in a way, it may make him more popular as a president because, you know, he is not a typical Republican. He's, you know, in favor of massive bailouts of, you know, of unemployment insurance and things like that. He talked about bringing home Edward Snowden, which was kind of great, and scrambles categories. I still like that a lot about Trump, but both parties, you know, they are basically just doing, you know, the Spider-Man meme on pointing at each other, the meme from the internet, you know, where it's like they are not the other person, therefore you should vote for them. And, you know, this is not good. I do think that the Republican Party, if they do not get past their hangups on not about identity politics, which, as Catherine was talking about or was a kind of alluding to, is bad when people only become markers based on kind of external, you know, skin color, gender, sexual orientation, demography. That's not good. But the Republican Party is really hung up on kind of difference and pluralism and tolerance and the cast of characters that America has already become. And if they don't get past that, where they can't let that go and focus on substance, it's, you know, they're facing, you know, eventual extinction.
So since you brought up Jake Tapper's monologue from the beginning of the show, let's go back to the newest member of the Republican Party's cast of characters, Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Georgia Republican candidate who has voiced interest in QAnon and a number of other conspiracy theories. I confess, every single time I read about Q, I start by thinking about the guy from Star Trek: The Next Generation, that like mischievous god character played by John DeLancey, who just sort of shows up
Nerd.
And is like, "Hey, Picard, hey, let's just mess with you for an episode." They're always great, right? They're sort of like good philosophical investigations of what like Jean-Luc Picard is really about, and then I just kind of nod off because every single time I try to read a piece about Q and QAnon, it just seems too bizarre, too vague, too disconnected from anything at all. I confess I can't follow it. Fortunately, we have Jesse Walker here, and Jesse wrote an entire book about conspiracy theories. You are generally the smartest person I know at explaining them, contextualizing them, helping us to sort out the extremely crazy from the slightly less crazy. So I want to read you a description from CNN of QAnon that is like the shortest and most succinct thing I think I have seen, and then just get your response to it, whether it's accurate, whether it's right, whether it's useful. So here from CNN, QAnon is a virtual cult that celebrates President Trump and casts Democratic politicians and other elites as evil child abusers. Aspects of the cult are downright delusional. Last year, an FBI office warned that Q adherents are a domestic terrorism threat. So, virtual cult, and will that virtual cult be gathering on Zoom for the RNC next week? Jesse, tell us about Q.
That's a good quote to pick because it hits two of my least favorite tropes in articles about Q. One is the cult scare rhetoric, which I can go off about for a long time. But in general, it's been interesting watching. I totally understand where it comes from. I mean, I'm often just when I'm just reading normal Democrats and Republicans on Twitter, I think this is very cultish behavior, but it is still the self-organizing nature of Q. This is a subculture with very little glue at its center. There's this one person or small group of people dropping these so-called clues or breadcrumbs, claiming to be this government insider named Q. And then everybody sort of rushes in and starts interpreting what they say and trading interpretations. And some of the people doing the interpretations are dead serious, and some of them are trolls, and some of them are in this kind of thinking about, well, maybe it's true, I'll think about it kind of way. And you have, that's why you have this constantly shifting set of stories. So it's hard to put your finger on exactly what someone believes if they claim to believe in QAnon, although you can be guaranteed that it's deeply weird and stupid. And that's not the way you think of a cult. You think of a cult as having like a leader at the center and this sort of hierarchy and these sort of efforts to sort of love bomb people and manipulate them. And I see, I mean, Mel Magazine had what I thought was a really bad article about Q recently. I mean, yes, I know, surprising to have a bet.
By the way, that's, yeah that's like you a dad clip where you just put Q in whatever topic.
Even by Mel standard, because it was, I mean, on the one hand, they had gathered these sort of very interesting and, you know, and sad accounts of people who've had loved ones kind of get drawn into Q and start affecting their lives and so on. But they had all this rhetoric of how, you know, this cult was manipulating them and so on. Said, no, this is actually self-organized. People are doing this to themselves. And it's
is
not
this
like
the first distributed cult?
All right.
It's like Bitcoin, right? There's no central node. It's like Bitcoin, but for
it's
cults.
A crypto cult?
Yeah, this is. That is actually the best Q metaphor I've heard in a while. Thank you, Peter. So, but the
wow, good work.
But the other thing that
but
does,
they'll be out of conspiracy coins in 2021.
Yeah, because
right? There's a fixed number of conspiracies that'll be
actually
emitted.
Will the next
stimulus be paid in Q bucks? Is the question,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So actually, I think Chuck E. Cheese is Q, and that his tokens are the conspiracy coins. But then the other thing that does, I just want to say, so many reports get this wrong. The FBI did not designate QAnon a domestic terror threat. Okay, and often I see those phrases, even those three words, put in quotation marks, even though they appear nowhere in that bulletin. This is a bulletin about dangers posed by people who take conspiracy theories really seriously. And this is something that's happened for a long time. Sometimes somebody deeply believes in a conspiracy theory and they target somebody for violence as a result of that. There's an open question of to what extent are they motivated by the conspiracy theory and to what extent are these the sort of sad and violent people, and the conspiracy theory directs violence that would happen anyway. But they give several examples, including some from QAnoners, some from others, and it speaks about just sort of what is, and it says it's likely that this is going to continue to happen. And it's not specifically about QAnon. It's not saying that this is a group that we are designating a domestic terror threat. And I'm not saying this to defend Q or anything. I just, like, for God's sakes, just read this bulletin if you're going to cite it in your article and characterize it accurately. Some people do it right. I think at this point, maybe a majority of stories do it wrong. So I've now gone off on my rant. I don't even remember what you were asking me, Peter, but...
that seems like correct.
I was asking you about that.
Hey, what do you think about Q? And you talk for a few minutes and then you're like, I don't even know where I am anymore.
Yeah. In conclusion, Donald Trump is going to arrest all of us tonight. Yeah.
No, this is what I was actually kind of trying to get at when I introduced this and talked about how I find it so difficult to follow, is that every time you, like, pull a thread on the QAnon conspiracy, like, you just don't know where you're going to end up, and you lose the beginning of the thread. You find yourself in the middle of, like, a rubber band ball of nonsense, and it just doesn't really seem to hold together, and yet it does seem to have drawn a bunch of people in. So
no, but wait, let's be more clear about that. It's drawn in the media right now, and the anti-Trump media, who won't shut the fuck up about it. You know, most people have no idea what QAnon is or whatever, but it is part of a growing kind of press rhetoric that Donald Trump is not merely a horrible, rotten, racist, sex offender, you know, evil, blah, 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 but that he is also ushering in an age of, like, you know, magic cults, and, you know, he's trafficking post office boxes. They're being picked up off the street and then sold to Russian oligarchs or something like that. I think you have to look at to the extent that there is, and I'm very curious as to what Jesse thinks about this, you know, the paranoia and the conspiracy mongering that's going on now is taking place in the mainstream press. And it's using QAnon, it's using the post office stuff, it's using everything that it can throw against Donald Trump. And they're acting like nut jobs. I mean, they are witch hunters, they are child, you know, people looking for satanic ritual child abuse. I don't know, Jesse, does that...
Yeah, so I want to get Jesse to weigh in on that.
Do you think of any of
that?
But
it does seem like the president has retweeted Q supporters, and there is... it seems as if there is going to be a Q supporter who is a Republican in Congress.
What does it mean to say you're a Q supporter, though? It's
this is what we've been trying to figure out.
You've mouthed a bunch of...
Let's ask the conspiracy expert we have here on this podcast. That's an idea.
She's an insane conspiracy monger who... Mao's conspiracy.
Yeah, so she has in the past sort of explicitly been a Q believer. And after getting the nomination, she gave an interview where she sort of backed down. She said, well, I noticed that Q's, some of Q's predictions didn't come true, to which I would say, you know, no shit. This is, like, one of the obvious reasons why. I mean, I got some conspiracy theories. If someone wants to say the CIA killed John F. Kennedy, that's something you can then look into. You can start, or if someone wants to say Barack Obama is covering up where he was born, you know, that's something you can look into, you know, and investigate. And the Q stuff, really, it's kind of hard to understand. It's not on that level of conspiracy. But anyway, I'm going off on another rant. But yeah, so she is, but she's certainly been a Q believer in the past, and she has that kind of mentality. There's another candidate who in Colorado who has a good chance of being elected who has played footsie with Q. She didn't say she believed in it, but she said, like, an interviewer was asking her what she thought of it. And I think probably sort of the kiss up to the interviewer, but who knows what else. She said, well, I hope it's true but, you know, we've been sort of this sort of place before. I mean, the John Birch Society had several members in Congress. It's interesting that, you know, Georgia is sending this Q believer to Congress because Georgia sent Larry McDonald, who was the John Birch Society's man and biggest supporter in Congress for a long time. Cynthia McKinney, you know, speaking of, you know, 9/11 truthers, you know, was also, you know, a Georgia congresswoman. So there's kind of two different issues here.
So what you're saying, this is a Georgia problem?
Yes, it's a Georgia problem. Yeah. If they would just secede, we'd be rid of it.
Well last time.
You know, they tried that.
So we, the Q Federate states of America, I know. So we, so on the one hand, there's the question of, could the Republican Party be doing a better job of saying, no, we don't want this, and rejecting a candidate like Green? And I think that's true. They could. I mean, Donald Trump was like dodging the question on Friday of, what do you think of QAnon? You know, he was not willing to say, you know, this is not this is nonsense, because, you know, he doesn't want to, I think it's because he doesn't want to alienate any part of his base at this point. It is also
true. What if it's
true,
because he is Q?
Yeah. So, and he doesn't want to tip his hat except by, you know, saying something with the number 17 or something. So but the other question is it being sort of covered in a hysterical way by the press? And I think that's true of a lot of the press coverage. It's an open question right now how many Q believers there are. And it's interesting. There's sort of like three measures you can look at. On the one hand, Joe Yasinski, a political scientist who's written for us in the past down at the University of Miami, he and his colleagues have been running polls. They had one, I think, in June, which basically showed he had done an earlier poll of Florida, and now this time he did a poll of Florida and of the whole United States. And basically the popularity of Q had not changed at all or in any substantial way in Florida since, you know, the last time he ran the poll, whatever it was, a year ago, I think, 2 years. And it was similar on the national level. There's also, I should say, though, another researcher named Marc-André Argentino, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who's just been tracking how much activity online there is. And he has seen a real increase since March in things like, you know, the number of Facebook groups, the number of participants, and so on. These two sets of data are completely compatible with each other. And not just because you can have people who are showing up in more than one group, and some of them are fake accounts, and some of them are just following because they're interested and they're not. It's also because you can have a situation where there's a cult TV show. There's that word cult again. And on the one hand, there's a big increase in activity around it. And on the other hand, if you polled the country, you would not see as much as a 1% increase in the number of people watching it. I mean, there are two different. So you can have a greater intensity of activity without a big shift in terms of the national numbers.
Do you think any of that is related to the lockdowns and the pandemic?
I was about to say, yeah, I think a lot of it is, I think a lot of what's in general has been happening in this country for the last few months is related either directly or indirectly to the pandemic. I mean, before March, Mother Jones had a piece, I thought a rather good piece, which was making the case that Q belief was in decline, just based on, you know, how many people were showing up at Trump rallies. Also, a number of them who were sort of identified with Q, if you asked them questions, it would sort of become clear that they weren't really into the theory. They were just sort of in a way of sort of signaling their opposition to corruption and that sort of thing. And the author of that piece has said, well, things have turned around a bit since then. So, and also the third measure I was going to mention, and this is in one sense the most bullshit measure, because there's no number to it, and it's easy to be misled by what's happening in your bubble. But on the other hand, it's something I can't help pay attention to, which is that over the last few months, I've heard more and more accounts just from friends of mine, of normie friends and relations of theirs getting into Q. I mean, this was not something I heard much about before 2020. I have a neighbor who I kind of suspect might be into Q because she believed some of the weird Hillary Clinton stories in 2016, you know, drinking blood and so on. But I haven't asked her. But there's, I mean, in general, like having someone who's not usually into this kind of stuff getting drawn into it, maybe because they're sitting around in the pandemic, maybe because there's an overlap between the Q community and the alternative health community and so on. So that's also something to keep an eye on. And all I can say is, I think there's probably some sort of increase. I don't think it's the kind of increase that some of the articles have been talking about. I think there's a good chance that if Joe Biden is elected, Q will disappear as a character. A lot of this stuff will not totally disappear. It'll mutate. It will take new forms, as conspiracy theories always do. On the other hand, maybe Q will continue and take on an entirely different guise. It'll be interesting to watch. Yes, so that was a big maybe, only in about 3,000 words.
Catherine, how worried about Q are you? How seriously do you take the idea that Democratic politicians and other elites are, quote, evil child abusers?
I mean, not very seriously. I am interested in the idea that part of the uptick of the media interest in Q, so the sort of why is Jake Tapper talking about Q right now question, that it's sort of the end stages of this now like 4 or 5 years long desperate search on the part of people who don't like Donald Trump to find the thing that is finally going to convince people who do like Donald Trump that he is really, really bad. And this is, you know, I think all of us have been in these conversations with people who say, like, well, surely if the public knew, if Republicans knew, if Fox News viewers knew that he, and then something, whatever the latest thing is. And sometimes it's the P-tape. Whole, it's the entire, you know, the entire impeachment was, you know, arguably driven by this, you know, the very strong emotional reaction to the feds snatching people off the streets in Portland. Now it's the mailbox removal situation. And Q is a part of this. It's this idea that if you could just say the thing, if you could connect Donald Trump to the bad, bad thing that people hadn't thought about before, they would realize he's bad and not vote for him. And this happens over and over in conversations in circles that consist entirely of people who don't even know Donald Trump supporters, for the most part, who have never met one. Or if they do, they don't know about it because they try not to ask their neighbors probing questions about their relationship to Q, as all sensible people should, in fact, not ask their neighbors probing questions about their relationship to Q. So I think it's at least part of that. It's just, it's end stage pre-election. Maybe this is the thing we can get Donald Trump with, because Donald Trump, as always, has given lots of fodder. He has retweeted Q stuff. He has absolutely flirted with this. And so if it stuck, it would stick because there's evidence, but it's not going to stick because people who like him have already priced in this and everything else bad that people on the left could say about him.
So in the end, it comes back to Billie Eilish and her most popular song, Bad Guy. Jesse, you want to get in here?
Yeah, I the funny thing about what Catherine is just saying is that we know there is one thing that voters are quick to tie a president to, whether or not the president is actually responsible for it, and that's the unemployment numbers. And you know what? When unemployment hit double digits, suddenly Donald Trump fell way behind in the polls. If they managed to rebound before November, maybe that would be his way back to getting reelected. But it's like people are searching for this thing that they expect to break out of, like, this, you know, the 15-20% of America who pays close attention to politics and affect them, when really, no, it's basically comes down to what does the economy look like? Am I going to have a job tomorrow? With this added layer of the pandemic, you know, affecting things too, because that affects people's lives, and you know, and it affects their lives, and they then will associate it with the presidency, whether or not you blame Donald. Actually, makes sense to say Donald Trump is responsible. I don't really think he was responsible for the boom. I don't ultimately think he's responsible for the decline. It's going to happen anyway under this kind of circumstances, you know, to some extent or another. But I mean, that's probably what's ultimately going to decide the election.
I don't disagree with that, but it's also true that Trump's numbers were not particularly better. Approval, disapproval, you know, when unemployment was at a historic low. I think the question here, and to go to what both what Jesse and Catherine were talking about in I think, similar ways, there is a pathologizing of anybody who would vote for Donald Trump. And, you know, arguably, you could pull this back to Hillary Clinton, you know, unveiling the basket of deplorables thing, where she essentially was saying this is not politics. This is something beyond politics that all good people must agree on, that if you support Donald Trump, you are contemptible and you are not worthy of serious discussion. And it is a pathologizing of, like, you if you say to somebody, you know what, I'm thinking about voting for Donald Trump, or and I am not, I'm like, I'm going to vote for the LP candidate like I always do. But if you even say, you know what, I think I would be more comfortable in a world where Donald Trump is president and he has a divided government to deal with. I would be more comfortable with that than having Joe Biden, a Democratic Senate and a Democratic Congress. People will flip out for the most part. And this, I think, is new. You know, I've been at Reason for 25 years or however many thousands of eons it is. I Cthulhu and the elders hired me back in the day. But this is uniquely bizarre to me, to see the pathologizing of, you know, anybody who would consider voting for Donald Trump. You're not just wrong. You're not just ignorant. You're not just evil. There is something sick about you. And it might be the real presence of social media and whatnot, but I think it's deeply disturbing to me because, and this isn't the Republicans doing it, it's the Democrats and people who are pushing to get Donald Trump out. They're making it almost, it's like it no person can have a decent conversation about a world in which Donald Trump might win and not be a total cataclysm.
Yeah. Quick clarification. Donald Trump's approval ratings have always been around, 40% or almost always there. But things like Biden actually being north of 50% and being in striking range in a place like Texas, that's more of a recent phenomenon.
Yeah, politics has become apocalyptic in a way that it wasn't even a decade ago. On the other hand, one could argue that the last 6 months have given us something closer to an actual apocalypse than a lot of us have seen before. So what are we turning to try and lift our moods? What are we turning to try and lift our mood during the apocalypse?
Dean Kamen, get out of town. Peter Suderman owns the
segue. I really
hope
that somebody mentions Lovecraft's Country, which I watched, but I'm not going to talk about. Catherine, let's start with you. What are you watching?
As always, I am using board games to get me through dark times. And this weekend, I played Codenames Pictures. Now, this is different than Codenames. If you have heard me talk about Codenames before, either in person or maybe on this podcast, Codenames is a pretty cool game. You basically, it's like a word association game. It requires you to create mental clusters of words and try to get your teammate to guess them. There's theoretically some framing that you are a spy or something. That's irrelevant. If you like Taboo, it's similar to Taboo. If you like Scattergories, it has some Scattergories vibes from back in the day. However, Codenames Pictures is the same thing, but each of the cards, instead of being a word, is a sort of vaguely Dolly-esque surrealist picture. It's a cactus with an elephant trunk or something. This is a fun game. It is interesting to play. I do not recommend that you play it with an economist.
Did you play it with an economist?
Because economists, maybe. An economist, it turns out, don't do great if you say, for instance, like futility as an idea that unites three complex images. They're like, yeah, no, I can't. I don't know what that means. So if you are going to play a board game with your literal-minded friends, I recommend Codenames. If you're going to play a board game with your artistically-minded friends, perhaps Codenames Pictures. But since so many people who listen to this podcast might veer toward the literal-minded, I suppose this is a little bit less of a recommendation than a warning to be sure you buy the right Codenames.
This reminds me of the great Deirdre McCloskey's book, How to Be Human, Though an Economist.
Yes.
Jesse? What have you been consuming?
What have I been consuming? I've been watching old Charlie Brown specials with my younger daughter, which there are a lot of them posted on Daily Motion. But I don't know if you want my blow-by-blow review of those.
Yeah, what's your favorite? Pick one.
The other day we watched both It's the Easter Bee Girl, Charlie Brown, and I was not able to remember if I had seen it until the last scene. I remembered a joke, but then we watched You're the Greatest, Charlie Brown, which again, I remembered, which is actually one of the really bad ones from the 70s. Yeah, I didn't remember them getting really bad until the 80s, but this is 1979.
Close enough.
At the end, they had one funny joke. And I remember that funny joke of Charlie Brown cluelessly running off the trek with his eyes closed and laughing when I was 8 or 9 years old. And now that was the one moment when my daughter, but I still think, the best one is Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. It's the sequel. I like to think of it as the sequel to A Charlie Brown Christmas, in which Charles M. Schulz said, instead of a testament to faith, we're going to do a testament to doubt. We're going to have this sort of character who's waiting for clearly the second coming, the Great Pumpkin, and everyone mocks him, and he turns out to be wrong. And isn't everything a lie? So, you know, it's certainly a good thing to watch at this time.
Feel good
story. That sounds like a really formative Jesse Walker story, right? Like about like learning to lose faith in the the myths that are told to you as a child, right? Like understanding that the world is constructed of lies and myths and like, you know, people like conspiracy theories, right?
No, it actually taught me that the Great Pumpkin is alive and real to Linus and will always be alive in his heart, and that we shouldn't just mindlessly debunk, but we should understand that we're all swimming in this ocean of myths and symbols, and isn't it great that's part of being human?
Jesse, I told you, we wanted to hear your thoughts about this.
All right.
I would love to see a Peanuts version of Jesus Christ Superstar.
What did you see instead, Nick?
I had originally I was going to talk about a nonfiction book that I think is very fascinating, but I started rereading this past week, The Crying of Lot 49 by Thomas Pynchon, a kind of mid to late 60s novel about paranoia. And it is, it's a really concise book. It was very popular in the 60s. It's widely assigned because it's shorter than Pynchon's other books, and I think it distills his essence, but it's a parody of conspiracy theory and a desperate search for deep meaning in random events. And it is now, it's kind of like Idiocracy in the sense that it started out as a critique of something or a parody. It is now kind of a primer or a text, an instruction booklet on how people are acting. I highly recommend Crying of Lot 49 by Thomas Pynchon. And a bit after that comes, of course, the great Robert Anton Wilson, Robert Shea, trilogy Illuminatus, which is a Baroque, a very Baroque parody of conspiracy thinking, which again is kind of deeply disturbingly the way we live today.
And Nick didn't mention, but Crime of Lot 49, which great book, Pynchon's best, is about a secret or alleged secret post office.
Yes.
And every time I see these people saying you should mail your ballots in via FedEx instead, I think, no, use Tristoro from Pynchon.
That always, the message always gets delivered, right? Even if you don't know exactly how.
I do not have a message gets delivered transition there to make. The message I am going to deliver is that I watched Palm Springs, and it's the best movie I've seen this summer. It is a like weirdly dark and despairing, but also hilarious, and in the end, like really affirming, kind of romantic comedy starring Andy Samberg and J.K. Simmons and a couple of other folks who you might have seen before. It's on Hulu, and it is a riff on the Groundhog Day idea, except that what you find out is it starts in the middle. So it takes place at a wedding, and one of the bridesmaids gets sucked into a time loop that Andy Samberg has already been in for an eternity. And he has like developed a whole philosophy of nihilism around living this same stupid wedding day over and over and over and over again. And he like teaches her his philosophy of nihilism. And of course, they fall in love and try to break out of it and become sort of, like I said, hopeful and cute in the end. But it really, like, in it, without getting too bleak, it leans into the incredible, like, darkness and despair of that scenario of essentially being forced to live forever in the same day with you have the choices that you have that you can make in that 24-hour period. But whenever you die or go to sleep, you wake up that same morning about to go to that same wedding, and you have to figure out what in the hell you are going to do with yourself. And it takes on a kind of unexpected resonance in an era where we're all sort of stuck at home living the same day over and over because of the lockdown. And that, folks, is the end of this podcast. Thank you all for listening. Come back next week where we will relive the same day over and over and over again with the Republican National Convention.